Oh, the shame that will get if you've let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
Alright, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo. As always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter. That's at Team 33. We're also on Facebook, also on iTunes, and you can find every podcast on offtheball.com and newstalk.com. Also, they're on some interviews are on YouTube, as is this week's one with John McManus, who is the author of Welcome to Hell, In Search of the Real Turkish Football. We'll play that out later. The laughs are because Joe Coffey has now started this
Derek Ryan is mocking me here. I mean, like, how else am I going to get great stats from Google to bamboozle
you? You come prepared. Research and study.
You usually come here and talk absolute nonsense and pretend that they're facts. You're actually going to have facts in front of you now?
Well, you know, maybe.
The laptop is there in case we need facts, and we will need facts. Derek Ryan, thanks
Hello,
for coming
in. Hello, how are you?
Kieran Bradley is joining us this week as well, so welcome along.
Oh,
good stuff. So before we get to play that interview with John McManus, we'll talk about other matters. I think one thing that did jump out to me was Troy Deeney. FA Cup semi-final, obviously, look, it's a great achievement. Watford have got to the final, beat Wolves at the weekend. Now, the thing that I think is jumping out to people is obviously the comment he made about the mask and Jimenez, the Wolves striker's celebration. I don't know what you made of it. Like, it's great to see somebody actually speaking out and being kind of brutally honest, but I don't know if we all warmed him.
It seemed a bit over the top, given that he'd won the match and he kind of wanted to revisit it so effusively. I don't know. It didn't really sit that nice with me. I kind of think there's a case of being almost a bad winner as well. I have a lot of time for Deeney. I just thought it was a little bit po-faced, like, oh, come on, it's football.
It was also interesting that he didn't actually seem to know about it until after the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the celebration was behind the goal. It also took Jimenez quite a while to get the mask. Quite a while being a few seconds. And it wasn't, like, handed to him. Like, it took a bit of effort to get the mask. I just thought a bit over the top from him during the game. And to be honest, I quite like Deeney's straight talking. I mean, it's... You know,
I do too, I have to say.
You know, it's what everyone's kind of thinking after the game, going, you look a bit foolish now, taking ages to get the mask and putting the mask on with, what, half an hour left in the game, probably? It was about the 60th minute when they scored the second, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it was the second goal that he scored. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it was the second goal.
It was half an hour left in the game and you're off celebrating and getting a mask on. I think a lot of people were going, you look a bit foolish now, but for him to say it, it is a bit...
But this isn't new. I mean, certainly in the Mexican League, this is a commonplace thing, it would appear, where they don a mask when they score goals. I mean, I've seen
Aubameyang did it there. Aubameyang
did it with the Black Panther, with the one from... It actually looked like it was from the movie. It's very common. I mean, it goes back to the Mexican wrestling scene.
Yeah,
it was just a little bit weird, I thought, given, you know, the other comments that we'll come on to that Deeney went on to talk about, that, you know, you would have thought a little thing like that, you'd just be like, oh, I'll brush it off, be like, oh, you know, whatever.
Well, we'll just play the audio of that now, actually, and I think the bit that's probably going to jump out is him calling Jimenez a loser.
Do you know what? I genuinely didn't see that until just now. There's a bit of me that wants to say something nasty, but I won't. But I'm glad he put that mask on. He can wear it out as well. Now he's a loser. So, yeah, enjoy the mask, but we got the victory.
I've got to ask as well, that goal, Jimenez goal, do you think it was offside? It would have been cruel to lose 2-1 to that.
No, I thought it was a good goal, personally. I thought it was poor defending from my point of view. Don't get me wrong, he's a top, top player. Like, I watch him and I think he's a nuts, like, he's very good, plays at the number 9 position on his own really well, great finish, but I didn't see the mask thing, so I'm quite happy I only saw it now, because I probably would have lost my head if I'd have saw that. So I think you've got to wear the mask and do all that stuff when you know you're going to win the game.
All right, that is Troy Deeney. So not that complimentary, although towards the end he did actually point out Jimenez is
a great player
as well, so that shouldn't get lost in the
But to use the word loser is... if he'd even said he's lost the game now, he might feel a bit foolish. But to use the actual word loser is very strong.
It's a bit harsh to say loser, all right.
Yeah. If say they lost the game, it's different. But loser is getting the...
Yeah, no.
It's going... Yeah. Studs up, like.
It is. It's not the first time he's gone studs up, anyway, because he's always been fairly open. And I think Arsenal, if I remember well, I think
the couple of times he has made the headlines, it's usually been after the, like, he went after Özil after Arsenal lost to them. But, like, he doesn't seem to say an awful lot when they lose themselves. I mean, or certainly, he's never made the headlines in the same way, like.
Yeah, I think it's interesting with Deeney, actually, because he seems one of these people who doesn't really suffer fools, and he doesn't kind of suffer the stuff around the actual, you know, carrying out of the sport that other people kind of engage in, and he's just a little bit like, oh, come on, I'm not having this.
Yeah, but then he's seen the real side of the game, so we're just going to play the other part. I think this, now both these interviews were with BeIN Sport, so yes, he caught the headline by having a go at Jimenez in the mass celebration, but I thought he was more interesting with this second clip where he's talking about exactly where he's come from.
Yeah, it's weird because I haven't really looked at it from... For the first time ever, I looked at it from a selfish point of view. I was literally just had a little toast with my family, and it was just like, I've come a long way personally, you know, from not just, people always go back to jail, but, you know, before that, you know, just grafting away and watching my brother do all this thing and trying to be a footballer, and I was just trying to support him. And yeah, a long, hard stint to get here, and that's kind of the emotion that come at the end. And I'm not going to lie, I was holding back the tears because it's like, I used to pay to play football. What, 12 years ago, I was paying £10 a week to play football. And now I'm going to be in the FA Cup final. Granted, against Man City, against a very difficult team. But I think every now and again, you just have that moment when it's just like a wave of emotion kind of hits you. And I'm like, I'm a big tough guy that everyone knows, but it was just like, nah, do you know what, this one's for you and for everybody that was upstairs. That's who I just went up and said, like, thank you. Like, I had a moment with my mum, which was special. It was special, yeah.
All right, that is Troy Deeney. The second part of that interview would be in sports just after the FA Cup semi-final. So that's him kind of discussing where he's come from. I thought he was fairly compelling on that. Like, we don't normally get that kind of an open insight into players while they're playing, exactly where they've come from, even references the fact he'd been in prison for a while as well.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I mean, I've got a lot of time for Deeney in terms of he does have that sort of hinterland. And I mean, we were talking about the criticism of Arsenal players and the like beforehand, but this is stuff that a lot of people were saying in that respect before. And it's nice that he can draw on personal experiences and say, I've been to the very worst, aspects of life, and it equips me all the better to talk about the best part. So I really enjoyed it. And I think...
That said, I would argue that what he said was, you know, if you put your mind, you can achieve anything, is a bit like some kind of Disney movie, you know?
Yeah, but he was also...
if you put your mind to it, you can do anything. I mean, let's be honest. There's,
you're ruining the mood, Joe.
There's a big population in this world that will go, well, I put my mind to things and it didn't work out.
We're having a Deeney love-in. You can't go against that.
It's just right, you know, like, well, it, look, it's a nice sentiment and all that, but it did read a bit like, you know, Disney.
Yeah, I think he also tried to puncture the social media side of things, where everyone tries to show their best selves.
I did agree with that completely. Yeah,
it was nice. I like the idea that you can redeem yourself, and I think that it kind of encapsulates what we're talking about with Deeney generally, is that I think he really placed a lot of value in football, because, you know, I'm sure that, I think it was Watford that he was at when he went to prison anyway, but they stood by him and they said that, look, you'll be in our club when you're out. And I think that, you know, that's not something that many people can kind of draw on as a life experience. So I thought it was really interesting. But
yeah, I did like I did like the line, actually, where he talked about how he used to pay, what is it, £10 to play football?
Yeah.
You know, like, it's a nice... he just reminded me of, I don't know, someone like Ian Wright, say, who was playing non-league football and almost seemed to be playing purely because he loved football.
Not Molly Cull through the academies, as a lot of
Modern day players are, yeah, you know. Yeah. And also, you know, as we spoke at length about in this programme before, that there are players out there, and, you know, it's fair enough, but football for them is just completely a job, nothing more, nothing less.
Yeah, well, it certainly isn't for him. Just as we were talking there, it actually just reminded me, do you remember the Watford-Leicester game when they were both trying to get promoted?
Oh, yes.
And that last mad, like, I think Almunia was in goal.
Almunia was in goal,
for Watford, saves the penalty, goes up the other end, and then Deeney's celebration, just first thing he does, jumps straight into the crowd, like, like one of those, like a mosh pit or something.
Yeah, I was delighted because I'm from St Albans at home, which is not far from Watford, so I've always had a little bit of an eye out for Watford, although I'm a United fan because, you know, I'm from St Albans.
You're a glory hunter.
Yeah,
it's like Derek Ryan.
Absolutely.
Listen, you know. So, but my flatmate Joe is actually a Watford season ticket holder, so he was over there for the weekend. And I just thought, in terms of the way the game actually panned out, going 2-0 down, you think, oh God, we were so close, and now I'm never going to get to see it. It was just fantastic for them to come back in that manner, and for Deeney to be so crucial, so that was really cool.
It did show as well that, I mean, even though the FA Cup is won by basically a top four club, by and large,
yeah, most seasons,
you know, most seasons, it does show that, and you need the minute to continue the integrity of the competition. But it, I mean, you contrast the likes of City, obviously, who have bigger fish to fry, versus this semi-final. And like, I know it was a 3-2 game and it was very exciting, but even for the fact, like, I mean, fans make
it means
these
a lot
events,
more to Watford,
and it just means a lot more. Ben Foster was speaking about he was speaking about, you know, this, like, he was saying that, you know, United, yeah, when he won the League Cup with United, it was like he got on the bus and they started talking about training and Champions League, yeah, and all this kind of stuff. Whereas obviously when he won it with Birmingham, when they beat Arsenal, it was insane. So
I think it's also the Cup is going to become a lot less and less important as it goes on, because there's still people who remember the Cup being so important,
yeah,
even in the 90s, like, yeah, for us, for me growing up,
the Cup was important in the 90s.
I was just,
yeah,
saying the other day, I used to love the 3 o'clock or the 9 a.m. starts on FA Cup Final Day on BBC One. They'd have a 9 a.m. 6-hour build up to the FA Cup Final.
Fantastic.
It was brilliant. I used to love that. Yeah. But there are obviously people now and kids now who don't remember the FA Cup being anyway important. So in the next 10 years, it's going to become less and less important. A la the League Cup, it's going to be just another League Cup, and it's all about the Champions League, getting that top four.
Yeah, weirdly
and
enough,
the Premier League.
The League Cup seems to be in a healthier place.
I definitely
the FA
agree
Cup,
with that.
Which is, yeah, might be the midweek thing. Actually,
I think it's the midweek thing. Make sure that the League Cup is an interesting competition in some ways. It's kind of has a bit of a niche going on there,
and also it's finished obviously in March, so it's kind of the first trophy of the season. Yeah. Can you win the first trophy of the season? Yeah. Whereas all the other attention at the end of the season is on the league and the Champions League.
Yeah, exactly, because I mean, like, Arsenal have won a fair few FA Cups now in the last few years, and like when I was growing up, I vividly remember the 2001 FA Cup where Michael Owen got the two goals, and I remember being absolutely gutted afterwards.
Yeah.
And now, if Arsenal won or lost, won, lost or drew an FA Cup final, I'd be very indifferent to it in general.
Because you won the team to win.
Maybe the 2014 one where you hadn't won a trophy for 9 years.
Yeah.
And Ramsey scored.
The Chelsea
winner,
one was enjoyable because they were playing Chelsea. But like, I mean, but the difference in terms of gravitas, I suppose, of the competition in 0-1 versus today.
Oh yeah, I wonder as well whether that's just a part of us just growing up and being in a different era. But I do definitely take the point, because I don't think it does actually have the same value as it did before, which is sad to say, but just these things happen.
Yeah.
Really, as long as we're
it's just the nature of English football, really. I mean, how can it have the same value when finishing fifth in the Premier League gives you so much more money?
Yeah. And it's funny how different clubs have different values as well. I mean, we're seeing it very keenly at the moment with Liverpool. I would say 100% if you offered to a Liverpool fan the choice of the Champions League or the Premier League this season, they would be doing
Premier League.
So, you know, I'm sure that the likes of Watford would absolutely snap your hand off
that's the thing. I think that the Premier League is actually a much bigger competition in terms of importance, say, than the old Division One. You know, like back when in the FA Cup, you could, I mean, I would say there would be plenty of people out there that would argue winning the FA Cup in the 70s was bigger than winning the league.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. That was the main competition in a way, or at least in terms of, I guess, gravitas, etc.
Yeah,
that was the thing. Everyone wanted that day out.
Whereas now the Premier League is just this huge thing to win. I mean, and if you're anyway, like, I mean, for Liverpool, like, there's been the Sunday Independent had an article comparing Mayo's quest for the All-Ireland with Liverpool's quest for the Premier League title, and it was comparing and contrasting the same thing about the want to win. And it's so true, though, that the Premier League for Liverpool is far bigger than the Champions League.
100%.
Yeah.
It means so much more to them.
Yeah.
Like, they won the Champions League in 2005. and they were kind of poor.
And yeah, it's funny because I'd view it the other way in terms of which would I like to see them win less. And, you know, I'd actually rather them win a Champions League, actually, than a...
You'd rather them win... I'm the same. As a United fan, I'm the exact same.
It's utterly pathetic as well. Like, I completely acknowledge that. It's just, you know, but, you know, in real terms, I actually do think that Liverpool fans, you know...
From the United point of view as well, obviously United are going through a similar thing that Liverpool are doing. I'd much rather United won the Premier League next season than won the Champions League, because, you know, United need to get over that hump of post-Ferguson and win a league. And then, grand, go back to the Champions League after that. But, you know, you need to win that league, and Liverpool need to win that league to kind of set themselves up as the best team in England, which hasn't been so long.
The nature of the Champions League, it is a cup competition, and it goes back to that whole thing of you can have just insane luck and make the final / win the Champions League, Liverpool in 0-5.
And Chelsea.
Chelsea won the Champions League with probably one of their weaker Chelsea teams of that period. And like, and even we have these arguments here about Zinedine Zidane and Real Madrid, and we're not the only ones. I mean, this debate happens everywhere about how good is Zidane as a manager, despite the fact he's won 3 Champions League. If he had won 3 league titles, it would be a completely different discussion. Yeah. Like, I mean... That's and winning the league is, you know, it's the gold standard in terms of how good is my team.
Yeah, because there's the Barcelona Real Madrid thing for the last 3 odd years or whatever it is. Barcelona seemed to win nearly every league title, I think, bar the odd one. Real Madrid win like once, and then Atletico won one, and then the fact Real Madrid won 3 Champions Leagues in a row. On paper, if you're going back to 60s or 70s, you know which one's the better team if I told you those stats.
Yeah.
But reality, Barcelona have been a far better team than Real Madrid over the last few years, just haven't done it in Europe in those one-off games.
Yeah. Because it's two legs. It's very... I mean, multiple things can happen. It's you know, like...
But isn't it funny, again, going back to United, the 1990 FA Cup win kick-started Ferguson's career at Manchester United pretty much. And 2016, Louis van Gaal won the FA Cup, and it was his last game. Yeah. He was sacked. Yeah. Like, it didn't matter less. If he'd lost or won that game, he would have got sacked. He ended up winning it, and he still had no chance. Like, it wasn't like, if you win this, now you might be able to keep your job. It doesn't matter. If you win or lose, you're gone.
It was basically announced when he was still in the stadium.
It was so unimportant, the FA Cup, you know what I mean? Whereas back in 1990, it was... You've won the FA Cup. I know it's a completely different era, but it just shows how far the cup has fallen. That doesn't matter if you win or lose.
I wonder if we could pinpoint like a point where that became, you know, the precipitous decline started to happen. And I wonder whether it is
just like the Ralph Wiggum where we can pinpoint more of his heartbreaks.
I know a lot. Yeah, like I know, sure, like the United dropping out of the cup.
Yeah,
Most, I think, a lot of football writers tend to pinpoint that as the moment where the FA Cup lost importance.
But then again, we're talking about
it left Wembley. I wouldn't say that's the main thing. But it was all around that period.
The best FA Cup finals in recent memory happened in the Millennium Stadium.
No, but taking it out of Wembley, did that kind of bring down the importance a small bit of it? I don't know if it did or not. My point is the fact that it wasn't in Wembley, you know what I mean? It was that 5 or 6 years. How long was that out of Wembley?
It was about five years, I think.
The first one back was 2007, because it was awful Chelsea versus.
Yeah, 2001 was the first one in the Millennium Stadium. But, like, I mean, you had the Liverpool-West Ham FA Cup final, and you had that Arsenal-Liverpool
one. Brilliant games.
They were both two really good.
But I guess these things happen around the same time. United opting out, and then the game being moved away from Wembley for a 6-year period, which is a long enough time.
Yeah.
Maybe those things happening together kind of contributed to it being seen as less important.
The move of English football clubs to kind of become these powerhouses in Europe as well has, I think, helped that you know, speed up. Because, you know, you go back to the 90s, English clubs were kind of at nothing, particularly in the Champions League and UEFA Cup. Cup Winners' Cup, I know they had some success, but English clubs were at nothing in the big competitions. So then for a lot of them, it was you're going for your domestic competitions, and that's basically it.
And also, obviously, if you remember, around the same time, late 90s, 2000s, there was something for 4 teams to win in the Premier League in terms of getting a top 4 place. Yeah. I know it was 2 and 3 and 4 after a while. Before, it was you either won the league or you got really nothing. That's so the FA Cup is a big draw.
Fourth place has become a cup in itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny actually, because now that we're sort of teasing out a little bit, it does seem that the actual construction of Wembley, and it might feed into, you know, the conversation we're having around Stadia at the moment, with the, you know, the Spurs one being open, it's a very soulless arena. Like it's not a great place to host a sporting occasion. It's not, you know, it's a lovely pitch and everything, but it's not as banked as it needs to be. The, you know, the sound escapes and it's very, you know, corporate and sanitized. And I just wonder whether that, you know, the old Wembley, I remember going to the old Wembley and it was like, it was mucky and there was, you know, there were, you know, green seats and all sorts. It was just absolute chaos.
It was far away from the pitch though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, you were a good way away. I mean, it wasn't necessarily a, you know, perfect ground, but like you could breathe the history in. It was crazy.
There was a while when they were talking about redeveloping Wembley that they had always planned on holding on to the Twin Towers. And then, I don't know, later on they decided to get rid of them. But I suppose the problem with Wembley is that, like, It's just a brand new stadium.
Yeah.
Now, maybe in 50 years' time, I don't know. But then these days, it's hard to know if Stadia will have that longevity, or will it be like the States where they seem to bulldoze them every 20 years? And
Which I think leads us to Man United's one. So I think you mentioned in the WhatsApp group the issue with Old Trafford. It's a piece by Daniel Taylor, I believe, actually, where he was pointing out a few issues in terms of you can see its age, and especially now that Tottenham Stadium, as has been mentioned, is there now and it looks great. Man City have a great ground, not very far away.
I mean, the thing about Tottenham, I mean, what do people think? Is Tottenham Stadium, I saw this bandied about a few places, that it is the first NFL stadium in the Premier League.
I mean, I wouldn't really know much to compare in terms of, you know, NFL stadium, but it certainly... One of the issues that I've had with the newer stadia, i.e. Etihad, Emirates and the like, is the fact that it's the bowl and it's not as banked as it needs to be.
I'd agree with that.
It's such an easy, you know, I say easy, but from a planning point of view, it's a very easy thing to figure out, like keep the acoustics really high and tight. From even tonight, we're recording as the Spurs City game is on, you can just hear it. It's really fantastic. And I just think
the wall, the yellow wall kind of replica.
And I mean, we do talk about Anfield. And we talk about the Anfield, the Kop, like, and...
I think it's mad. It's only now, in the last few years, clubs are kind of saying we need to work on this atmosphere thing. Like, Old Trafford was... A library was dead. Highbury used to be the same.
Highbury,
it was,
yeah.
But like Old Trafford was dead for so long. It's only in the last few years they're starting to talk to fans groups about getting fans together so they can sing in an area and try and improve the atmosphere. Well, and it's such a big thing because why would you go to a game and sit there?
The problem they all have is that they're all... It's a complete contradiction for the bigger clubs because they're trying to get in the... You know, the tourist fan who's there for one day. And, like, let's be honest, the vast majority of tourist fans aren't going to shout because they're not used to it. It's a new thing.
Well, absolutely. But again, would tourist fans come back and go, that atmosphere is unbelievable?
No, they won't.
I would love to go back again next year. Or would they say, I've seen that now, it was grand, and that's ticked off the list.
True,
you know?
But I suppose that if you're a fan from say Thailand or Korea or whatever, that you're not going to be put off by the fact that your friend said that the atmosphere wasn't that great. It's a once in a lifetime experience, but it sucks because it's not great. And Old Trafford certainly has fallen into a level of decrepitude recently enough. I mean.
I'll read the quotes here from Daniel Taylor's piece, actually, because there's a few interesting bits. The roof is so old and leaky, it is quite common for torrents.
In one of the stands.
To gush through in times of heavy rain. And though I wouldn't want to put anyone off their entries in the executive suites, probably sums up the way the place is kept that Old Trafford has had long periods with a rodent infestation.
Sure, Jose Mourinho would agree with that about the rats.
Well, they had a massive problem. But then that's not unique. I mean, the Emirates has had mice infestations.
The stand they're talking about is the South Stand, which has been around since the 60s. They can't do it up apparently because the rail track is behind it, so they can't build over the rail track. But they've kept the stand the exact same. It's still the same roof and the same everything, the same dressing rooms as they were in the 60s are still there.
But be careful what you wish for as well. I mean, are we going to go down the road then that you hear that, oh well, we're bulldozing Old Trafford and we're going to build a stadium a little bit outside, out in the suburbs, well, you know, a bit further out in the from where it is? Or
I think Taylor mentioned in that piece that there's the rail track near the ground as well.
Yeah, so they can't, there's certain things they can't do or they're restricted I think what he also implied, maybe they don't want to spend that level of money to do. But
well, they don't need to either. And when, how regularly is Old Trafford completely sold out? Obviously the Barcelona game will be, but on a regular basis, it's 70,000-odd, but it's not 75. It's very rare that it would be sold out, that they'd actually need to expand to go any further. The point is, I think, back in 2005, I think it was when they filled the quadrants in. It was so far ahead of any other stadium
in England. It was.
And now other stadia have caught up. And Spurs, one being a prime example.
It's still the biggest, though.
Still the biggest.
It's funny, actually, I didn't realise until I revisited the piece that it was actually pre the Glazers. That was obviously all sorted because it was there in 2006 and it would have been very recently finished as well. So, I mean, it's very clear that there's a, you know, there's no grow on there. Parts of Pony Money.
Yeah, and I don't, like, I was there in December and I don't think it needs a massive amount of work. Like I say, I think it just needs to be kind of looked after and taken care of. And there are bits, like the South, I actually quite like the South Stand. It's a small stand. It feels kind of a part of this old stadium. It's an old stadium. It's not a brand new stadium like, you know, the Spurs or the Emirates or whatever. It's a kind of, it's part of this old stadium and it's nice. I quite like that. But yeah. I do agree that there are, it does feel a bit like
I'd be of the opinion it's more important for the likes of United to retain the character of a stadium than to build, and that stand does that because
it's where the dugouts are. It has the old dressing rooms in. If you go on the tour, it goes in there. There's all, I think it adds to the experience
it's
of Old Trafford.
Red brick area, isn't it? Yeah,
the red brick, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's where the two dugouts are, and when you see the manager walking up the touchline, that's that stand. The Sir Bobby Charlton stand.
I genuinely think a lot of this stuff could actually be sorted by a proper deep clean, literally get the power washers out and do that kind of cable. Because honestly, that is a part of the issue with Old Trafford, is that part of it's just look grotty because it's been there since like 1910 or whatever. So, it just needs to spruce up.
Yeah,
and get your marigolds on raffle.
Deal with the mouse and
the rat.
I can see the reason for Spurs. Obviously, their stadium was very small by the nature of the way the Premier League has grown.
It was only 30-something thousand. Anyway.
Yeah,
it was very
35, 36, yeah. Like
in comparison to all their rivals. Yeah,
yeah.
And the zoning issues around North London, North East London, Haringey kind of area, like the housing that's directly on top of it is not the same as somewhere like sort of, you know, the outskirts of Manchester and Salford. Yeah. So, I'd be really loath to see them move, and I don't think it'll happen anytime soon.
But the article made a good point about the area, the land around Old Trafford is owned by Manchester United, which I wasn't entirely clear or sure about. They have two big car parks, the one outside the Sir Alex Ferguson stand, which is a massive car park, and the one opposite the Megastore. And they don't do anything. They're just two big car parks. In this day and age, car parks are kind of like who really drives the game? Do you need two massive car parks? Yeah. I don't think you do. The point being that City have done a lot of work around the Etihad. I think they built a school there. They've got a smaller
football pitch that holds 7,000.
Yeah, and they've got loads of facilities in that area. It's kind of a little village in itself. Yeah. Whereas United have Old Trafford, and that's pretty much all they have. Obviously, the hotel was recently built there, Gary Neville's hotel, and the Class of 92's hotel is just across the road. But United have built nothing outside of Old Trafford, and maybe they could do something like that to, I'm not saying build a small stadium, but do something around it to kind of build up the area rather than having two ginormous car parks, one ginormous car park outside of it.
Just on a slight parallel point, one of the issues that was raised soon after the Palace game at the Spurs new stadium was the fact that the travel is a nightmare now because Seven Sisters Tube is pretty much down the high road from there, but you've got suddenly 25,000 more people there, and I just wonder whether actually the club just kind of accepted that as the price of modernisation, or they're actually going to be working with various transport bodies to get that sorted, because United's actually, in a relatively privileged position. You can kind of get it's a short walk to the tram and things like that as well.
There's a train right beside. Yeah. That's the South Stand, actually. It's right at the back of the South Stand. And whenever I'm there, I don't see huge queues into it. Like, there's in their queues, but they kind of go pretty quickly. So they obviously have something there where it kind of works quite well.
You're not leaving in the 80th minute or something, are you?
No, I'm not, absolutely not. 95 all the way.
But I think that, I suppose the only downside of all this, and maybe Spurs is, I mean, everyone is raving about the stadium. It's just the bowl design. I mean, are we looking at in 20 years' time, every single top flight football stadium will be a bowl design with the exception of Anfield and Old Trafford?
Yeah, it's, what do you mean by the bowl? Like, as in, from when you're looking down.
When you're looking down,
it,
or, that it's, right, yeah, I see what you mean. You know, yeah, yeah. I mean, it may, I can understand the reasoning behind it, but it, I just feel that, in my opinion, that's where the character is being lost in a lot of the stadia, mm-hmm. particularly in the new stadia, in that. I mean, Wembley is to say, like, you know, like the unique thing about Wembley is the arch. Mm. But I just wonder, like with Spurs, they seem to be, in fairness, that they've made a big deal about the level of the embankment.
Yeah,
and the fact that they have one continuous stand as well, like Borussia Dortmund.
The yellow wall, yeah,
yeah, like the yellow wall. Sorry. So it may not impact them, and maybe they will have. Maybe we'll look to that stadium as one with character.
I think that's the big thing, isn't they actually care about the atmosphere in the stadium. Now, whether, like, we'll see. Obviously, it's a new stadium. Give it a couple of years and see if it's still the same. But like they've taken steps to ensure that the atmosphere is good, and that will
exactly.
help long term. And I think that's a big thing.
I mean, West Ham. I mean, no, West Ham. Are they ever going to solve the problems they have there?
No.
I don't think so. I think that's the, again, I imagine that it was probably raised in certain planning meetings with the board, with the likes of Gold, Sullivan, Brady, yeah. etc. And they may have just accepted that as the price of modernisation, the price of getting a few people.
Yeah, it's effectively a free stadium for them, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of clubs as well over the last few years have been caring more about the facilities for... You know, for banks, like for, I'm sorry, for corporate facilities, all that kind of thing. They care more about the corporate boxes than they do about the atmosphere in the place. And I presume Spurs have a million corporate boxes as well. Don't get me wrong, but they've actually put a bit of thought into the atmosphere, which for me, a lot of clubs haven't done. And maybe it's about time. And again, United are doing the same thing in the last couple of years or so. They've actually started talking to supporters groups, and maybe that's the way of the future. Nothing to do with the actual bowl or the structure of the stadium, but actually try and help the atmosphere in some way, shape or form. And obviously Spurs have done that.
Yeah, I think it might be the fact that we're just reaching kind of phase two of new stadia. Like, if you look, when was Emirates open? 2006?
Yeah, 2006.
And then, you know, you had the likes of maybe the King Power or St Mary's or whatever done beforehand, but like not real mega stadia like that. And maybe they're just learning things and moving on.
Did I hear the Arsenal Stadium and then Benfica Stadium alike, they're all kind of vaguely similar, I think, in terms of design.
The likes of Arsenal will, I don't know, I would think if they continue down the track of being a, you know, like winning competitions here. If Arsenal's history mirrors the previous century, you know, Arsenal will continue to grow. And you would wonder that, I mean, what will they do? Like, because that's the thing that hasn't been explored from what I'm aware of with this bowl design. I mean, like, how do you enlarge that? How do you make that stadium bigger? You know, because
you can't knock down one stand.
You can't knock down one stand like they would have done in previous times and build a new one. Mm. I mean, or is the solution to have an Aviva like solution where you have a I would think if you need to make it bigger.
Yeah, they feel very completed. They feel very IKEA versions of stadia where you kind of you build it and that's done, and you can't really do anything with it unless you knock the whole thing down again.
So I wonder, like, I mean, because you know, if you could argue that, well, maybe that it could happen that Arsenal need 70,000 or 80,000 capacity. I mean, where do you go in terms of making it bigger? But I don't know. Interesting, anyway.
Yeah. Which I think brings us to our final topic before we do the interview with John McManus on Turkish football. But we're just with the fact that City and Tottenham are on in the background there. The games between teams from the same nation is something anyway. I think we were going to chat about.
This is really
interesting.
I mean, like riveting. Listen, like you really know how to sell that one.
Why wasn't this not my idea?
Oh, so it's only your ideas, Raf, that you get excited about.
I get excited about everything. I even get excited when Mayo gets brought up in Arsenal, etc.
We're having a break from Mayo now for a few weeks.
Well, it's still got to mention earlier. Compared to Liverpool's quest,
just waiting to get back on the All Ireland bandwagon, Raf.
Yeah, but I don't know. Do you generally get excited, say, if it's an All Premier League fixture?
I certainly do.
I love them, yeah.
Yeah, I've way prefer them. Like, I mean, tonight, like, I wanted to see Spurs against City rather than Liverpool against Porto.
Porto are no match for Liverpool.
But even
really.
If it, to be honest, if it was Liverpool versus, well, if it was Liverpool versus
Barcelona.
PSG or something like that, or Barcelona, yeah, it's a tougher one to call, in fairness.
Do you know I don't really like them.
Why not?
Well, because if you... Let's presume that the team that you're playing is roughly of a similar standard to yourself, or you know you're not seeing a Porto / Liverpool / you know this kind of thing. I think you just lose a little bit of it. Like, I grew up loving, you know, when Juventus came down, I was like, bloody hell, this is Juventus, this is, you know, Del Piero and Nedved, and like, obviously in the years before it was really, really seen every day, and like, I like the idea of a foreign, you know, club coming in and you seeing a Milan or
something a bit different. That's why I'd prefer it. It's something a little bit different than watching. Now, obviously, I'm not going to the games. Yeah. I'm only enjoying it through TV now. But, it's that idea of teams you don't get to watch every week, and then you see them tested against. Well, that is what the Champions League is supposed to be about.
I've always feel that all English Champions League games do not play out the same way as their equivalent Premier League ties. And I'm not talking about like that. The results not the same. What I'm talking about is that they have the approach seems to be different. It's not exactly the same high tempo.
It's a two-legged affair.
Yeah, maybe.
Generally,
I mean, like, there's been some amazing ones. I mean, Arsenal Chelsea. I remember for all the wrong reasons, but Arsenal Chelsea in 0-3, 0-4 was a fairly
It's the year Arsenal should have won the Champions League.
And
all those Liverpool Chelsea ones around that era.
Someone's better than others. I mean, I think the very first one, where Mourinho was in charge, that was an awful.
Was that the ghost goal one?
Yeah, four or five.
That was a horrible two.
It was even just the rivalry between the two sides in Europe solely for that 3 or 4 year period where they met, I don't know how many times.
They met a lot of times.
I mean, I might be wrong, that didn't seem to be a rivalry to me before that period.
Yeah.
Like, before probably, I would actually say that game, or that tie at least. But yeah, like, there was a 4-4 between Chelsea and Liverpool, I seem to remember, in the second leg when they beat them 7-5.
Yeah, there was some.
Yeah, but I know, I agree with Joe's point there. Like, you do certainly get a different dynamic. I just think, on balance of things, I'd kind of prefer to be playing a foreign club. But, United and Arsenal have had some cracking battles over the years. I mean, Arsenal haven't really turned up, but
because I remember the 09 one. I think was in a semi-final.
Arsenal were well beaten there. But Arsenal Liverpool was another cracking game. I think that was the 2008. When Walcott got this sensational goal.
Ta-da, Wenger!
He made a sensational run. He squared it for Adebayor.
That was it. Everyone thought Arsenal had won it, and then all of a sudden they go up and give way an insane penalty.
That was typical Arsenal.
It was basically, if you could ask, well, tell me what the next 10 years of Arsenal will be like, that would have summed it up in those couple of minutes.
Play this in perpetuity.
I do think as well, though, that the Champions League game, like, you rarely get a league game, unless it's like the last game of the season or like the last three games of the season, that means so much as a Champions League knockout tie.
Yeah.
Like, obviously there's so much on the line. If we lose this game, we're out of the Champions League. It's a big deal. Unless you get a league game in April between Liverpool and City, for example, that really means
that much.
You don't generally get, like, league game in December. You don't want to lose, but you lose. You have 5 months to make it up. For me, there's more to it. Like, you know,
it's funny, like, watching how the decade has developed. Like, I mean, we're talking away here while Spurs are playing Man City in a Champions League quarter final in their new stadium, and like, I well remember, I think it was 2010.
Is this the knockout?
The knockout Champions
League
game.
I
remember so well. Like,
I was in college. I was watching it in the PAV in Trinity. At the time,
City, and it was winner takes all.
A long time ago.
That's great.
If I think it finished 1-0.
On a similar note, the Chelsea Liverpool game the year before Abramovich, the summer before Abramovich got Chelsea the last Champions League place. And apparently he was looking at Arsenal. And apparently, I heard recently that David Dean was, that Abramovich was told by a Swiss bank that Arsenal went for sale. And David Dean basically pulled his hair out of his head and was just going, why was that told to him? Of course we're for sale. We massively want to sell it. But anyway.
Exactly. That Chelsea, if Chelsea hadn't won that game, Abramovich probably would never have bought them. Yeah. Would he have bought a team who weren't in Europe or in the Champions League? Probably not.
Probably followed up the Arsenal link.
They were in like huge financial trouble as well, right?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know what the figure was.
Ken Bates was selling them for looking to sell them for a pound.
Yeah, it was a pound. Yeah, I think Abramovich bought them for very, very cheap.
But he inherited the debt then, you see.
Yeah, because they changed everything. I think even Newcastle, I remember them being in the Champions League around that time.
Oh, they were.
Then Chelsea kind of rise, the likes of Newcastle completely fall away. Tottenham's rise was delayed. Arsenal essentially just kind of lost out as well because they were the best team in the country.
I think
only Man United in a way kind of benefited, but only because they saw this challenger and then Ferguson was like, okay, we got to.
But it's gas. Up until then, United were able to just throw their weight around in terms of buying anybody they wanted to buy. Like, they would just pay an extra $5 million on top of anybody else in the Premier League, where suddenly now this other team were able to compete with them. And then obviously 4 years, 5 years down the line, City were then able to throw the cash as well. But up until, that was 2004, up until 2004, United, throughout the whole Premier League, were just able to say, name your price and we'll buy you.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was just thinking about the All England ties we were talking before. There was a point in 2007 where United played Milan in the semi and lost, and Liverpool had obviously already got through. But I was living in Liverpool at the time and I was thinking, you know, there's a very real possibility that Man United would be playing Liverpool in Champions League final here. And while obviously that would be the best thing that's ever happened to a Manchester United / Liverpool fan to win that, it genuinely occurred to me that I couldn't take losing more than I could enjoy winning.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's like in the quarters and semis, you can kind of write it out. Like, because even when we're talking about these matches, it's pretty difficult to actually remember what year was which.
I've pretty much forgotten that Liverpool beat City last season in a Champions League knockout, because unless it's the final, you move on very quickly. Like,
yeah, it's like the Copa Libertadores there with Boca Juniors and River Plate as well, which I think both of them, that was like the biggest game in their history.
Yeah.
And these are clubs with massive, massive history behind them.
Yeah.
The fact that this is like, obviously they never met in a South American final.
How did that go?
I mean, like, we can all remember watching Chelsea versus United for the Champions League in Moscow.
JT.
I mean, not just for what happened, like, but you just for, like, I mean, it was a very memorable game.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, it was the fact that it was Chelsea United, and just, it was, you know, like, if it was another game, you might kind of remember it, like, because it was pretty dramatic, but it was those two and the fact that they were going for everything at
the
time.
But again, we knew the people involved. We knew JT. We knew, you know, Ferguson. We knew everything that was going on there. Whereas if it was United against, not even Barcelona, but if it was United against another team, you know, even Bayern Munich, would you know everybody who was in the Bayern Munich team?
The point was,
like, everyone hated John Terry, and to see him step up and about to win the Champions League for Chelsea, you know what I mean? And then for him to blow it the way he did, it was just incredible, because everyone kind of hated John Terry and didn't really care who won the league, won the game, as long as it wasn't John Terry, pretty much.
There has been, obviously, we're just talking about English games at the moment, but like
Milan Inter have had
Milan,
a couple of them,
which was
Old Trafford, which was probably
the worst Champions League final in the last, I'd say it was the worst Champions League final this century.
You blame Old Trafford for that.
I genuinely struggle to remember who won that game.
Every
time I remember it, someone
Milan,
won.
Milan won it on penalties. But it was Dortmund Bayern there about
Dortmund Bayern. There's been a load of all Spanish finals.
Never in El Clásico. It's always been either Valencia, Real Madrid, Atletico.
I think Valencia, Real Madrid was the first time where you had two teams
in a final, because the round before, Valencia had beaten Barcelona over two legs to get in as well. So
that was the 2001.
That was 2000, yeah.
And Madrid.
Isn't that
won.
Strange though? Because, for example, Nottingham Forest obviously only got into the European Cup the second time because they won it the first time. Isn't it strange that over the years two teams never met before?
No, they changed the rules. They changed the rules in the 98-99 season. That's when they brought in this idea of a second phase. And that's when third and fourth teams started qualifying for the Champions League.
But, like, it's strange that, for example, like, Nottingham Forest won the European Cup in 70, I'm going to say,
77. Back then you had to win your league to get into it.
No, but unless you won the European Cup, my point is, isn't it weird that, say, Forest and Liverpool didn't meet the year after? They, you know what I mean? And a German team didn't do the same thing. It's kind of strange that over the years that never happened before.
Sure. Well,
yeah, because they're obviously two very strong sides, so there's a good chance of them getting to the latter stages of the European Cup.
Yeah, I think and I don't know, some people probably were annoyed with the rivalry, but I think the only one I would have thought maybe would have been just the most epic final would have been when Mourinho and Pep were in charge of Barcelona and Real Madrid, and they'd met, you know, they did meet in that 2010-11 season. And it got very contentious. I think they played about four games between League, Cup and everything else.
Yeah,
and
Champions League. In like 2 weeks,
Within 2 weeks. And it got really contentious. But imagine if that was a final.
Yeah.
Imagine.
Yeah.
You want United Liverpool and you want an El Clasico in the Champions League final.
Yeah, I wouldn't be as mad about an El Clasico now. I think then, just because the two teams, two managers actually were hated.
I have to say, like, now, I mean, Madrid are poor. Barcelona
are not as good as they were.
I would say Barcelona, well, like, I mean, back, if you go back with Pep Guardiola, you were talking about the team reinventing the game. Now I'd say Barcelona are like an excellent team, like, but like no different than any other excellent team out there.
Kind of living on past glory.
Well, like, you know, they're an excellent team. They're not doing anything amazing. They're just they've got great players and they win games. Like you know, like I would argue that Man City are doing a lot more. I wouldn't even say they're changing the game, but like they're certainly more visible as to what they're doing than, say, Barcelona is, in my opinion. I mean, they're chasing four cups at the moment.
Yeah, it's so open this year.
Yeah,
I don't think there's a real standout winner, because City, you know, have this kind of reputation within the Champions League, and, you know, maybe that'll change this year, but looking up behind me, it doesn't seem to be, you know, roaring out of the gates anyway, let's put it that way.
If you look at what's going on in Europe, Brexit hasn't gone that way yet. In England, I mean, you are looking at probably the most exciting title race we've had in. If it keeps going the way it's going, this will go down as a better title race than the City United one, purely because...
I just think because both sides are incredible.
Yeah, both sides are incredible.
In 2012, City were a very good side. United were a good side, but probably relying on the Ferguson factor to get them over the line. But, like, you know, both good sides. Well, both these sides are absolutely incredible. If it goes to the last day like that one did, it will beat it. Obviously.
It will, because, like, I mean, the reality is that in any other time period, maybe with the exception the year Arsenal went to unbeaten, but like pretty much any other year you could say, well, Liverpool could well have won the league.
100% they would have won the league.
I think there's only four other years where Liverpool, they were saying basically Liverpool have already gotten like one of the highest points totals already, or they've already surpassed
they passed United in, I think it was maybe 2001 around that time, as in, like, you know, they've done that with six games.
I think Leicester won the league with 70s, some points total of the 70s, 80. Like 79 or 80 at most, I'm pretty sure.
Which was mad because they won that by 10 points in the end.
It was a terrible season.
Yeah. Such a bad season. Well, I mean, it was the best season ever.
Like,
if you're from Leicester. not if you're from
who could screw up the least?
Well, yeah. Because that should have been, again, Arsenal or Spurs. Like, Spurs, it's essentially Spurs lost that one, and then obviously Leicester. Rewriting history. Leicester did well.
Yeah, it did give us that cracking game, though, where Chelsea just beat Spurs up on the pitch.
Oh, yeah. Like,
and Jamie Vardy's party.
Yeah, Jamie Vardy's
drinking Blue Wicked in his gaff on a Monday night.
He's into Skittle Vodka, isn't he? Skittles and Vodka, that's
something. Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Skittle Bra.
A real college drink.
But anyway, we will switch over now to something completely different, which is obviously Turkish football, as I mentioned at the top. John McManus has written the book called, he wrote it last year actually, we were just kind of revisiting it here. The book is called Welcome to Hell, In Search of the Real Turkish Football, and I started by asking him why he wrote it.
Well, Raph, I think the impression of Turkey in Turkish football in the UK and Ireland is this phrase, welcome to hell, right? Which comes from a game that Manchester United played in 1993 when they travelled to Istanbul to play against Galatasaray, and they were walked into the airport arrivals lounge, and they were met by hundreds of fans screaming, shouting and holding banners written in English, welcome to hell. And then over the next kind of 24 hours, they had quite a tumultuous experience. Eric Cantona got sent off. They drew the match. They went out of Europe. They got beaten up a bit by the police. They left cursing Turkey and their luck. Then fast forward to 2009, which is when I first went to a match in Turkey. I had the complete opposite response. I was welcomed in. I sort of got to know a very strange fan club for Beşiktaş, who are quite leftist and socialist and, you know, take part in protests against forests being cut down. And I thought, this is quite different to the image that is in my mind and, in you know, from living in the UK and growing up there. And so really, I wanted to write the book to try and correct, like, narrow that gap, or at least just to expose people in Ireland, in the UK, to like what the other sides of Turkish football really.
Yeah, as you said, the whole welcome to hell thing, of course, dates back to the Manchester United game, November 1993. The perception, I think, in England also, it becomes even, like, I suppose, hardened, more crystallised again a few years later in the UEFA Cup run of 2000 and involves the Leeds fans. Can you just take us back through that kind of incident? Because I remember it well as a child, but it obviously had a huge impact on the way Turkish football was viewed, particularly in England, and then for us here as well, through that prism as well.
Yeah, sure. You're right to pick up on that. It was, perhaps this is crystallised the Welcome to Hell moniker, really. Year 2000, semi-final of the Europa League, Leeds are playing Galatasaray. For both of them, it's a huge game because Galatasaray, even though they're a huge Turkish team, that's the furthest any Turkish team has got in European competition. Leeds, obviously, good history, but the most successful side of the present era. They travel to Istanbul, and the first chapter of my book is devoted to trying to unpick what exactly happened. And at the risk of making it a spoiler, basically, it's hard to know exactly. But what did happen was two Leeds fans were stabbed to death in, like, you know, horrendous circumstances. Well, what I mean by it's hard to know what happened, it was hard to know exactly why that happened. I spoke to lawyers who represented both sides. I spoke to fans on both sides. And really, it just is there's a lot of just different opinions. And I try to sift through this. And I can't come to a definitive answer. I can't say, aha, it was due to this. I mean, my gut instinct is that stereotypes on both sides. So on the lead sides of, like, Turkish fans as violent and crazy, and on the Turkish side of English fans as hooligans, you know, I feel as if perhaps these ran away with experience, and that those stereotypes were kind of fed into behavior and led to an incident that just got escalated really quickly out of hand. I don't condone what happened at all. Like, I don't want to be seen as like an apologist for, you know, what happened. It was really horrendous. But I don't know, I guess my point of view is that was 19 years ago, and I wanted, you know, like, understand a bit more why that incident could have happened, and also then to think about moving beyond that, you know, and look at the history and other elements of what's going on in Turkey.
Yeah, because it's interesting an incident like that happens, and also the fact that Galatasaray are more linked into high society as well. And I've always read that they, in comparison, obviously they're based on the European side of the Bosphorus Straits, and they've always been linked in, I guess, to the upper class, even going back to the founding of the club. I just found that kind of interesting as well. And then the fact that despite this kind of high society link, they're linked in as a kind of hooligan club too whenever they're in Europe.
Well, so this is an interesting point that basically in Turkey, you've got three big teams. You've got Galatasaray, Fenerbahce and Beşiktaş, and they're all based in Istanbul. But actually, about 90%, 90, of the whole population of Turkey supports one of those three teams. So you're absolutely right. Their foundation was by basically rich kids in the early 20th century. And Galatasaray today still has a link to one of Turkey's most prestigious high schools, a bit like if Eton College was affiliated with, you know, like Chelsea or something. But because they're supported by about 90% of the population, you can find fans from a whole range of backgrounds that support all of those three teams. So I don't know what it's like in Ireland, but, you know, in England and in some European countries, one football team is associated with a particular, like, class background or sometimes even religious background, right? Historically, obviously not everyone is by that, but you know, they have these things. This is a working class club, this is a middle class club. And whilst Galatasaray is definitely, you're right about the foundations and the people in charge of the club, very much aristocrats and rich and influential people. But I think for all those three sides, at the fan level, you'll find plenty of hooligans and plenty of middle and working class people who aren't hooligans, just normal people. Really, truly, they cut across every demographic, as I found out in my travels around Turkey.
Yeah, of course, there's the Graeme Souness incident in 1996 where he plants the flag. He's often in Ireland anyway. He's a pundit here on Virgin Media, one of our stations. But he's often talked about that moment where he runs in the middle of a derby between Galatasaray and Fenerbahce, plants the flag in the centre circle, and it's one of those kind of moments that I suppose stirs the pot a bit. But it has the atmosphere in these derbies, it's become more sterile, hasn't it, as well? Just some of the measures they've brought in.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Turkish football crowds are very lively in general. And to someone familiar, I can't speak for Ireland, I've never been to a match there, but for someone familiar with English crowds, going to a Turkish football match is quite an experience, even on an off day, because everyone is just a lot more passionate. The whole stadium normally sings rather than just one section. Everybody stands. You don't have like a seat number. You just stand where you can find a spot often. And you're right that the government have brought in quite a lot of fan ID system, which has been very unpopular. And they've increased punishments for bad behaviour, which have all sort of taken the edge off certain elements. But there's a still real kind of passion that is expressed during football matches. And I mean, it also, paradoxically, it hasn't really solved certain issues with violence. I mean, this time last year, the Besiktas manager had to be taken to hospital because a Fenerbahce fan threw something at his head during a cup match last April. So, you know, this and that, the game had to be abandoned, and it sort of descended into chaos. So, I don't know. It's a very lively experience, even on an off day. Although, of course, even 10 years ago, it was very different when I first went there. And of course, you know, people who are older than me say, oh, if only you were here in the 80s and you really would have seen what it's like. But I don't know. I'd encourage anyone, if they're on holiday in Turkey, to check out a game, because they, you know, to an outsider, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Your book takes us through a lot of different football clubs as well, outside of the big three, outside of Trabzonspor, who'd be reasonably well known as well. Osmanlispor is one I've listed down here, so they're the security firm team. Is it right that non-attendance at a game, it's a sackable offence if you're a member of the security of the security firm itself?
Well, like in a roundabout way, yes. Basically, this is a side which was kind of generated by the Ankara municipality. So Ankara is the capital. It doesn't really have a huge footballing tradition like Istanbul. So one quite crazy mayor generated this side, but couldn't get fans to go to games because there's a couple of sides in Ankara, and fans are those teams, and they don't want to be fans of a new team. So yeah, in order to kind of fill the stadium, workers for the municipality, security workers for the municipality, it turned out, were kind of being lent on to attend. There were rotas. I mean, I think that it's probably, and I, outside the game, I could see people being checked off on lists and ushered in. And I think that perhaps if you missed a game, it wouldn't be like, right, you're marching orders. But it definitely would have been frowned upon. It was part of the wider sense of the obligations that come with the job. And people were a bit, people didn't really want to talk about it. And it was quite hush-hush because they were scared of getting into trouble. But again, it just shows as soon as you start digging about, there are some quite interesting tales which are under the surface in Turkey, which I've tried to capture in the book.
Yeah, one of them is your visit also to Diyarbakir. So this is the Kurdish area, and there's a club there called Ahmedspor. So you went there in February of 2016, right? And the atmosphere, mm-hmm. obviously, with the political backdrop, it was quite dangerous.
Yeah, so at that moment in time, there was a sort of a lot of fighting between the government forces and like an armed insurgency being led by people linked to the PKK, which the Turkish government sees as a terrorist organization. Parts of Diyarbakir were kind of walled off or by the security services, where they were, you know, sort of fighting street to street with these people. I, needless to say, stayed well away from those areas. I went into town and I went to this football match because Fenerbahce, one of Turkey's biggest sides, had drawn Ahmedspor in the cup. And just to give an equivalent, like the Ahmedspor, a very small side, they're, I don't know, in the fourth tier, I think, third or fourth tier, should have done my homework. It was quite surprising that they got to the stage where they're playing Fenerbahce. And it was just a very interesting atmosphere in the stadium, a lot of security forces. And actually, the funny thing is that, you know, professional footballers are professional footballers. So the game itself, I think it was a 3-2 victory to Fenerbahce. It passed really without incident. But obviously there's a much wider issue going on with, at that time, and even today, you know, there's very much, like, you know, the Kurdish conflict, as it's known, has been bubbling along in Turkey for decades, and it's very interesting to see how something even as football even gets sucked into it, right? You know, that's kind of what I decided to concentrate on in this particular chapter, is how and why football becomes part of it.
Yeah, and that issue with the conflict between the government and Kurdish rebels as well, given the fact of what was happening over the border in Syria as well, which is not a million miles away, how does that have any impact at all on football?
Oh, it's a good question. I mean, I'm not... The politics, the current politics, as opposed to, like, Kurdish groups in northern Syria, I'm not 100% up to date with. But, I mean, that... What has happened is the whole issue in Turkey has definitely cooled down a lot since 2016, when it was really when there was fighting in cities. There isn't really any like fighting in urban areas in general right now. In terms of football, the incident has also calmed down. That side, though, Ahmedspor do frequently complain that they are treated as, by Turkish nationalists poorly. I occasionally see news stories, so I don't know, it's still an issue which bubbles up in football. Although it's also important to remember that a fifth, like 20% of people who live in Turkey have some sort of Kurdish background, and lots of them are also fans of like Galatasaray, Fenerbahce or Besiktas as well. So we're not talking as if this side represents all Kurds. You know, it represents a certain demographic of Kurds in Turkey, and that's, again, like, it's just more complicated once you start to dig down, is sort of the conclusion of many elements of Turkey.
You've mentioned again Galatasaray, Fenerbahce, Besiktas. They've been the traditional powers, they've won the vast majority of league titles, Turkish cups, etc. But there's a new power there, Istanbul Basaksehir. They don't have a lot of fans, and they seem to be an establishment club as well. They've been taken over by the Ministry of Youth and Sports. How did they emerge?
Good question. So this side, yep, they were like a municipality side. So in Turkey, the municipalities often have football sides. Taxpayers' money is used to fund, well, sports operations in general, but particularly football sides. So this was like an Istanbul football side. It never had very many fans. It was founded in like the late 80s, early 90s. And then in 2014, it was sold to a like private consortium of businessmen, one of whom is related to the president of Turkey, President Erdogan, and all of whom I think it's fair to say are, you know, sort of pro-government in varying stripes. But the club went from a public to a private club. In Turkey, there aren't very many private clubs, unlike in England, where every club is private. In Turkey, they're kind of members' associations. But this club, because it became a private club, actually developed quite a lot of flexibility. It didn't have to answer to members, perhaps secured some favorable contracts, although it's hard to know, but it was just basically quite well run. This is the kind of inconvenient truth to lots of people who don't like the fact that this club is doing well. is that actually they have a good manager, this guy called Abdullah Avdija, who was there before 2014. So they've had consistency. They've recruited well. And they from lower divisions and abroad. They sold Cengiz Ünder to Roma for like 15 million euros after he helped them a lot. They have a scattering of older players from Adebayor to Clichy who have all chipped in with a few things. And they're quite a well-drilled side. So on the one hand, they there is a link there with the government. Although on the other, they are also this season played the best football and kind of deserve to be top and probably will be champions. So, but at the same time, they have no fans, as you pointed out. I mean, they're 5 years old, so it's quite difficult to generate a fan base from scratch when you're up against 100-year-old clubs. And so this is the question. Everyone's thinking, well, what's going to happen? Are they going to be around for decades, in which case maybe they will? Or are they going to disappear again, in which case, well, maybe we'll just look back and say, oh, that was a funny turn. I guess to be continued.
Yeah, Erdogan's another interesting, obviously the president of Turkey. I guess local government elections haven't been going too well from recently. But in terms of football, there's always stories about him. Potentially at one point he could have been close to having a career in the game as well. Not sure how true that necessarily is. And I've seen him playing in charity games where he scores goals. But again, is he being tackled properly? I would imagine not, like most of our leaders. And obviously he was a fan of Kashim Pasa, I believe, as well. So the whole football thing is quite interesting. But Hakan Şükür, who is one of Turkey's leading footballers, he was charged, I believe, with insulting the president, and he's now found himself in exile as well. It's a very interesting situation.
Yeah, so this is a very complicated situation. Hakan Şükür is a sort of prominent supporter of a group of people called, in Turkey called like Gülenists, who are people who support this preacher called Fethullah Gülen, who lives in America. And for many years, this group was quite close to particular people in the government in Turkey. But in 2013, they fell out spectacularly. And since then, there's been a real purge within Turkey of people who are associated with this group. And in fact, the government blamed this group for the failed coup attempt in 2016, and you might remember that in July 2016. I mean, it's very hard to know for certain if that's the case, but they are certainly seen in Turkey as being behind that. And yeah, so Hakan Şükür was quite a prominent person within this group, and like he kind of saw which way the wind was blowing, I think, and left in 2013. Just before the real intense crackdown, and he's moved to California and he's essentially in exile. Yeah, he's been charged with many elements. I mean, in Turkey, there are thousands and thousands of people in prison associated with this group. He has been charged in so can't return to Turkey, really. And it's important. A lot of people outside of Turkey, they think this all sounds like a terrible like line from some sort of like weird political thriller or whatever, and it's a load of rubbish. But this group is not a load of rubbish, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they were very involved in football and also many elements of the state. And so it's again, like in Turkey, you never really find the black and white. It's hard to say for certain X or Y, but there's a lot of kind of mysterious grey, which makes for you know, kind of frustration sometimes, but also, you know, I don't know, an interesting book, and leave space for book two, I guess.
Yeah, well, there's definitely scope for that. I suppose before we let you go, from time to time we get to see the Turkish national team, not at World Cups for some reason. I think they seem to fall foul of whatever's happening in qualifying and just doesn't work for them at that stage, but they've been at a good few Euros and have tended to do well as well. Huge population, football mad as well. Is it fair to say they kind of punch a bit under their weight in terms of tournament qualification?
Absolutely. I mean, Turkey is, for a football mad nation, it's really, really squanders an embarrassment of riches at its youth stage. It has a really poor, most clubs have a really poor, poorly designed youth team system. They're heavily reliant on basically convincing people of Turkish origin raised in Europe, so obviously mostly Germany, but, you know, in the Netherlands, the UK, people who are born and raised there to come and play for Turkey.
And actually, just on that, actually, it's very similar to here because I guess, I don't know how aware you are of the situation or even the Declan Rice case, for example, but we would have a lot of players born in England and other places who we've attracted to play with Ireland, either through the youth teams or later on. And it seems now, with England not having a huge pool of players, there's now kind of a dilemma for some of the better ones, and like, say, Declan Rice or the Aston Villa footballer as well, Grealish, Jack Grealish, they've all ended up kind of choosing England instead. So I guess there's a kind of similarity there with Turkey.
Definitely. Although I guess Ireland is, I don't know what the population of Ireland is.
Much smaller. About 4.5
Right, exactly.
Million, yeah.
4.5 million. So there's perhaps, you know, when compared to England, you're looking at quite a misbalance in terms of, and the wealth within the football. But at the same, but between Germany, for instance, Germany and Turkey, the population's the same. The wealth in football, you know, Turkey is the seventh largest football league in Europe by revenue. So it's behind the Bundesliga, definitely. But there's still a lot of revenue there. So in a way, I find it less excusable in a way that Turkey is doing this. I mean, fine, look, I'm being a bit harsh, because if players can play for you, then by all means go and do that. But they lean too heavily on basically products of youth systems elsewhere, and so they need to fix the youth system at home, I think, so that Galatasaray, Besiktas and Fenerbahce are generating, you know, there's no class of 92 at any of these clubs. You know, they've not produced consistently great top-notch players when they really could have. And maybe until that happens, it might be difficult for the national team to be consistently successful. So we'll see.
Yeah, but anyway, John, thanks a million for taking the time to chat to us. Lots of fascinating things there in terms of Turkish football, but there's so much more to discover. And of course, it's in your book, Welcome to Hell, In Search of the Real Turkish Football. As you said, we might get a second edition at some point with more developments in Turkish football. But for now, anyway, thanks a million for taking the time to chat to us.
No, thanks. Thanks very much for having me, Raf.
All right, that is the interview with John McManus, and that actually brings us to a close now. So, lads, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Raf.
Raf,
a pleasure as always. We're back for round two of these Champions League games next week.
We are indeed. Kieran Bradley, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
Joe.
Raf, pleasure as always.
And Derek.
Thank you, Raf.
Take it away, Johan.